Welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios and the EAA Chapter 84 podcast. I'm your host, David Weber, and in this episode, we will sit down for a conversation with world record holder Arnold Ebnetter. Arnold gives us details on the E-1 airplane he designed, built, and flew to set a world record for flight distance of an aircraft weighing less than 500 kilograms. Arnold shares what it was like during the flight and the peculiar question he still receives to this day about that flight. Our conversation wraps up as Arnold tells us about his storied aviation life, including his time in the U.S. Air Force. After we finish up with Arnold, we will talk to a young 14-year-old Ashitha Arakapudi, who has been appointed Chapter 84's Young Eagles Youth Ambassador. I assure you the passion Ashitha has for aerospace will make you want to hear more from her in the future. We close up this episode with some chapter news and updates. Be sure to like Chapter 84 on Facebook and then follow us on Instagram and Twitter. And now I bring you Arnold Ebnetter, followed shortly by Ashitha Arakapudi. Well, welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios. This is your host, David Weber, and I am immensely honored today to bring you really one of my personal heroes, and that is Arnold Ebnetter. Arnold's been part of the EAA chapter for several years now, and his biggest claim to fame is the fact that he set a world record for an aircraft distance, one line under 500 kilograms. Arnold, welcome to the studio today.
Thank you.
Arnold, I'd kind of like to get into talking to you today, but I'd really like to sort of focus in more on the E-1, which was the aircraft that you set this record in. The E-1 was a design that you came up with while you were college at Texas A&M. And from what I understand, this was something that was inspired by a senior project, and you had read an article by Juhani Heininen, and from there you thought, wow, what could I do? Kind of tell me what you were looking at in Juhani's design that you thought maybe you could do different with your design. Was there something in the materials that he did that you thought maybe would work better?
Well, my thought was that he had modify an airplane to do this, and what would this airplane look like if you were designing it for that specific purpose,
which was the record attempt of
to set a record. That's correct.
Okay. And you had this specific record in mind when you were thinking of this.
Yes.
Point to point, not around a track.
Yeah.
500 kilograms or less.
Yes.
And it had to be also a reciprocating engine, right? An internal combustion engine.
Yeah.
Okay. So you looked at his design. You said, what could I do that would be specific for this rather than modify current design?
Yeah. Yeah, what would the thing look like if that was the primary requirement for it?
What did you see that were the flaws in his aircraft? Was it his wing airfoil? Was it, because I know that aircraft was more of an aerobatic aircraft, which aerobatics is quite different than trying to go for efficiency in long distances.
Yeah, it was a question of, okay, what modifications should he have made to it, or, it might have improved it even further. But basically it was a question of, okay, if I start with that, the premise that, okay, I wanted to set this record, now what it would look like.
And so he had an airplane specifically designed that he designed himself that was for aerobatic purposes.
Yes.
And you said, I need to design this aircraft for long distance efficient flight.
That's correct.
To me, that would mean a longer wing, shorter cord.
Right.
Is that what you looked at in your design?
Right. And you do a trade-off study to find out what that, in some ways, the answer was, little bit surprising, I guess you'd say.
Okay. And his aircraft, I know, was mostly aluminum aircraft construction with some fabric on it. And you looked at a whole bunch of different types of materials to use, and you mm-hmm. eventually settled on aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And why was that? Why was the aluminum such a benefit over, let's say, wood and fabric type aircraft? Was it because of the loads that the aluminum could handle?
Yeah, it could handle them. Ended up to the Boeing surplus store was the the treasure trove.
So, being a Boeing engineer for several years, you would end up going down using your 15% discount down at the Boeing surplus store, and you'd come up with these materials that Boeing was either throwing out or had no use for.
Yeah, these are very high strength alloys, and particularly anything that was loaded in compression.
So I know that you specifically looked at the top of the spar with that compression loads, and there was this new alloy out there at the time, 7075 aluminum, and that really piqued your interest.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
So, but you maintained with the 2024 on the bottom of the spar? And that's because that was mostly in tension, not in the compression.
That's correct.
And so that probably gave you a lot of weight savings, being able to change to that 7075 up on top.
Yes. Yeah. The saving was significant.
And we're talking pounds, not ounces kind of savings,
that's
huh?
That's right, yeah.
That's very big when you're talking efficiency for a long-duration flight.
Yeah.
Every gallon of fuel is 6 pounds. So, and in the aircraft that you flew, a gallon of fuel was quite a distance. Yeah. So,
we're looking like, I don't know, 40 miles.
So every pound that you could save was another 40 miles. And those add up.
Mm-hmm.
Those add up really quick. We've talked a little bit about the actual interior of the aircraft, and I know that it was pretty sparse in there. There wasn't a lot of creature comforts. But when I was crawling around in the airplane years ago, I noticed that you had a screwdriver handle of some sort that was your stick for the control stick, the grip. Is this kind of the way that your philosophy was on the design? Did you say, hey, there's something there in the shop, there's something over here that I could use, and that's what you just decided to use in the aircraft?
Basically that was.
Well, that's a true EAA, right? You know, it's true experimental builder right there. You know, you see something at the local hardware store and you say that can work, or you see something sitting in the shop.
Mm-hmm.
And that can work. And for you, like you said earlier, going down to Boeing surplus was definitely a big buy.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we don't have Boeing surplus anymore these days. It's all it's all online. So the E-1, as it ended up in the design, had a wet wing. And for those of you that don't know, a wet wing really means that the wing itself is sealed and can contain fuel. You don't have a bladder in there. You don't have another tank. You basically seal up the wing and all the rivets and everything along those lines. I would imagine you had a few leaks in doing that.
Yeah, we chased those for quite some time. Finally got them all under control.
So we had a total of 74 gallons that the aircraft would handle.
Yeah.
So you had two wing tanks?
Yes.
Two wing tanks, and then you had a 9-gallon header tank, and I would imagine you pumped the fuel to the header tank. Is that the way that you typically did it?
Yeah.
Okay. And in doing such a did you find that a complex system, or was it basically simple for what the aircraft was?
Yeah, it was basically simple.
Was there logic behind what fuel you would use between the left tank or the right tank? Was it to keep the aircraft in balance, or was there something else there?
We just decided to, because we didn't have any aileron trim, I don't know, it wasn't a problem, but yeah, we did alternate.
So for the record attempt, well, I shouldn't say attempt, for the record, when you set the record, you didn't top off the tanks. You simply put in the amount that you calculated you needed for that day. And from what we, from what I understand, what I've read, that was somewhere around 60 gallons. Was there any thought of, hey, maybe I should just put in another 10 gallons for insurance? Or were you pretty confident that you had what you needed to get there?
Well, we put in as much as we could and still.
So it was more of a weight issue.
Yeah.
So you only had 500 kilograms.
Yeah.
And so you put all the fuel in that you could, yeah, right up to that 500 kilograms.
Yeah, so we would be staying within that class.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did that 500 kilograms include you, or was it just the aircraft?
No, it included, that's the gross weight.
So everything taken off on the wheels.
Yes.
So you went on a diet for several years before you...
Yeah.
You didn't go out to Outback the night before?
No.
All right. So when during this record attempt, you take off from Painfield, and you took off not early in the morning, but a little bit later in the afternoon, and flew through the night.
Mm-hmm.
What was the reason behind that? Why would you rather fly at night during this record than during the day?
Well, flying at night was going to be inevitable. I mean, it's because of the length of it.
Was it a choice because of less traffic? Was it a choice because of better weather conditions?
Well, it has to do with the weather. I guess basically with the weather conditions.
Was it weather conditions just for that day, or was it weather conditions that you knew at nighttime there was consistent better weather at night?
No, I think we just considered it to be better weather at night, yeah.
One of the things that I've always been fascinated with the E-1 was your attention to detail, especially when it came to things like weight. And one of the things that I've noticed, and you and I talked about this many years ago, when you were flying my Sonics, you had a particular interest in my wheel pants, and you started questioning me about weight and all of the ways that they were mounted. And you actually at one time considered putting the Sonics wheel pants on your airplane, but instead you went with what's called an afterbody fairing on that wheel.
Yeah.
And this was strictly just to save weight. You couldn't find other means to reduce that. But you knew you needed some sort of a fairing on that wheel.
Yeah, well, there was weight saving, and just the afterbody was.
That gave you the best advantage, less weight.
It was the best weight trade off. Putting the forebody, I guess. You didn't gain much.
So this kind of dovetailed into your choice to go with fixed gear rather than retractable gear.
Yeah.
Strictly a weight penalty.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. And like I say, I got some information that showed that that the afterbodies would be effective.
That the trade-off between the weight of retractable gear versus the drag that you were going to incur with the fixed gear was such that the fixed gear was a better choice.
Yeah.
And that gear was just a bent spring type of gear?
Yeah.
Was it something you made yourself, or was it something you borrowed off another design?
Well, let's see, where did I get those?
Sitting in the corner of the shop and you said that'll work?
Yeah.
Well, we know it's spring.
Yeah.
And it was probably aluminum, or was it steel?
It was aluminum.
It was aluminum spring.
Yeah.
I bet that made landings a little touchy.
Yeah. Let's see. I think Boeing Surplus was involved somewhere in that.
Boeing Surplus.
in coming up with those materials.
Boeing surplus to the rescue again.
Yeah.
What was the engine that you had in the aircraft?
The engine was a Jabiru. Yeah.
The 2200.
Yeah.
The four-cylinder 2200.
Yeah.
And obviously, when you first started designing this aircraft, the Jabiru wasn't even something that was around.
Mm-hmm.
So you must have been considering other aircraft engines. Was it like a Continental?
Continental engine.
Like a the C-85,
mm-hmm.
C-90, sort of an 80 to 90 horsepower
yeah.
variant. But that's a significant weight difference between the Jabiru, I think.
Yeah, when the Jabiru came along, like, aha.
Aha. Did you talk to Jabiru headquarters at all, or you just went and saw it at one of the shows and said that was an engine that I could use?
I think I did talk to them at Oshkosh.
At Oshkosh.
When we were meeting there.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking 40 pounds worth of difference between the C-85 and the Jabiru.
Yeah, it was quite significant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would surmise probably a little bit better on the horsepower range with mm-hmm. the Jabiru. Did that affect any sort of a propeller choice then? Did you start playing around with different propellers at that point? Because the Jabiru turns at a much higher RPM
mm-hmm.
than what the Continental does. So did that start to have an effect on what you were thinking about with the design?
Yeah, as I go, I think I went through a couple of propellers, but...
So you would just fly up, put a propeller on and go for a flight and see how it performed?
Yeah.
What kind of testing was that? Was it like static ground testing first, or was it always in the air testing?
It was all in the air testing.
So push the throttle forward all the way and yeah. see what RPMs you got?
Yeah.
Is that the way you flew the plane all the way from Payne Field to Virginia, was full throttle, or was there a sweet spot in there that gave you the best efficiency?
Let me think.
Do you remember the manufacturer of the prop? Was it Prince, or was it...
Cessnich.
Cessnich, okay.
Yeah.
Because I remember you telling me you had to set it out once to have it repitched.
Mm-hmm.
And you just get up to altitude and do these testing. Was it always the same altitude that you were testing at?
Yeah.
What was that altitude? Do you remember?
I think it was 3,000 or so.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
How many propellers do you think you went through before you found the one that you wanted to use?
I think it was about 3.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's actually pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So you must have done your calculations right then when you sent off for that propeller. I can't imagine you just saw something in a catalog and said, order it.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about kind of the flight on the E-1 rather than the E-1 itself. I know that several times after your successful flight, you went and did talking to different groups. Obviously, you gave a speech in front of the EAA. You gave... presentations to local chapters. You even went and talked to some kids in classrooms. What were some of the things that the kids would be interested in knowing about the E-1?
Well, with the kids, it was always, how did you go to the bathroom?
Now, did you give them the truth on how you went to the bathroom, or did you make something up? What was your answer to that, typically?
Oh, let's see. How did I answer that question?
Did you tell them the truth that you just used a pee bottle?
Yeah, I think that was basically
what it was. Now, that's not what you did when you flew the F-100.
Mm-hmm. No, we had a relief.
You had a relief tube.
We had a relief tube there, yeah.
Yeah, I figured you would have had a relief tube in the E-1, mm-hmm. considering how comfortable you were with that. During the flight, your record-setting flight, you flew essentially over the Rockies. You flew, I would imagine, 9,000 feet or so
mm-hmm.
Over the Rockies. Was that... kind of the altitude that you ended up staying at, or did you have to vary that altitude a lot throughout your flight to avoid weather?
No, we didn't have any problems there.
We're able to maintain a pretty good flight level and a pretty good track.
Yeah.
Now, I know, obviously, winds are a critical factor in long-duration flights like that. You can get a headwind and really set you back. Did you ever come across something that was completely unexpected in winds, or were most of the winds right where you thought they were going to be?
Well, let's see. That did turn out to be a factor. I did climb up to a higher altitude to get some more favorable wind, yes.
Okay. That's pretty amazing that you could go that far, completely across the United States, and only have to deviate slightly for wind directions. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of planning. Now, did you have communication with your ground crew at all during the entire flight, or were you left to your own? It was just air traffic control.
It was just air traffic control.
Okay, so you had no way of communicating with anybody on the ground.
Yeah, and let's see. I'd been having flight following, and all of a sudden they shut me down.
So they, in the middle of your flight or some portion during your flight, they released you from flight following?
Yeah.
Did they know that you were on a record attempt, or was this something that they didn't care about?
They just didn't care about it. They didn't want to talk to me anymore. That came as kind of a surprise.
Because they must have known what your destination was.
Yeah, but I remember they just basically said, we're going to bed.
So you're not even talking to flight following.
Yeah.
You're up at, let's say, 8,000, 9,000 feet over the top of Minnesota or the Dakotas, and nobody's even talking to you.
Yeah. When the family was tracking me, all of a sudden, he's gone, And it wasn't.
Yeah, because we didn't have ADS-B at that time, so there was no way to track you other than through flight following.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, there you go off the screen.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you made it. When you landed in Virginia, obviously the family wasn't there. Who was there to meet you in Virginia?
The representative for the...
The Federation. The governing body of who was regulating this record attempt.
Yeah.
Oh.
He was there to meet me.
Because in this flight, you had to tell them where you were going to land.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike earlier flights, the Federation would let somebody fly and just land wherever they may. But with your attempt, you had to tell them you were going from point A to point B.
Yeah.
Which made it that much more difficult. Mm-hmm. But you were still able to do that.
Yeah.
And what time of the day was this?
I landed about around 11 o'clock.
Oh. Nobody there but one person after this incredible record attempt.
Mm-hmm.
And no marching band, no ticker tape parade down New York. But later on, you ended up receiving the Blériot Medal for this record.
Yeah.
How'd that make you feel?
Good.
Was it sort of like the putting an end cap on all these years of designing the aircraft? Because I know you had tried the record attempt almost a year prior to that, weren't able to do it. Mm. You made the record, you set the record, and now you're getting the Blériot Medal for this. That's quite an achievement.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about, you were a pilot for the Air Force during the 50s, all through the 60s, and even a little bit into the 70s. And during that time, this country really put forth an effort to go to the moon. As everybody knows, President Kennedy with his famous words about going to the moon and how we do these because they're not easy, but because they're difficult. It was sort of a real epic time in this country, and you're out flying F-100s in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Did it ever occur to you at that time that maybe you should go do something safer, like traveling to the moon in a space capsule? Or were you perfectly content flying around in F-100s having people shoot at you? Did it ever cross your mind to go into the space program?
No, not really.
Did you find it more comforting to fly over Vietnam and have people shoot at you? Or just the fact that you never even occurred to you that there might be a different path for a guy with your skill set?
No, I guess I just did what I had to do, yeah.
So if NASA would have called you up, if President whatever called you up and said, hey, Colonel Ebnetter, we'd like to have you join our space program, what would have been your answer?
Well, I think that probably would have been, yeah, let's go.
Let's go. If they offered you a ride on one of the SpaceX rockets today, would you go?
I think so.
You think so?
Yeah.
So it wouldn't take long for me to say yes either. So we talked a little bit earlier, and one of the things that you said to me was that one of the most interesting people that you've met during your aviation career was Dick Rutan. And come to find out, you actually knew Dick
mm-hmm.
during Vietnam.
Yes.
Was he flying F-100s like yourself?
Yes.
How did you hook up with him after Vietnam? Was it a friendship that you carried all the way through, or was it because of your interest in aviation that you ended up connecting with him?
Let's see, Eileen had something to do with that.
Oh, okay. So maybe at some presentation or something along those lines?
Yeah.
And so you guys are still friends to this day?
Hmm.
Great.
Yeah.
Something else that you told me back in Vietnam was you guys would do something with a close formation to extend the range on your F-100s. How close of a formation are we talking? Are we talking inches here, or are we talking feet?
No, we're talking feet.
Okay.
Yeah, you would move in until you're... Well, until your wingtips were about in trail with each other.
Okay. And this would end up, the result being an extended range.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, you could. Basically, it's increasing your aspect ratio is what it's doing. You can increase the range a little bit there. It can be annoying because it changes the lateral trim, and if we were flying with a guy we didn't particularly like or something, what you could do is you move in and he has to retrim a little bit. Okay.
And then you'd move back out.
And then you move back out.
And he'd have to retrim again.
He'd have to retrim again. Yeah.
Just poking a little bit of poking, right? Yeah.
Occasionally they would figure it out. Okay, you guys, knock it off.
A little bit of a question here. You know, it's a little bit of a fluff question, but a little bit of levity here. Do you think you'd be happier in the cockpit of an F-100 or the basket of a balloon?
Well, probably in the cockpit of an F-100, but basket of a balloon is tempting. Let me go that way.
Well, I see I can see the desire for the F-100, but there's one problem with the F-100, which is where you're at
mm-hmm.
in the F-100. Most likely... Somebody's probably trying to shoot at you in the F-100.
Yeah.
the basket of the balloon, nobody's shooting at you.
Yeah.
You would still choose that F-100.
I think so.
Yeah. Probably. You told me earlier that's probably one of your favorite airplanes, if not your favorite airplane.
Yeah, we went through a lot together.
Do you have any idea how many hours you flew in the F-100?
Yeah, what is it? Yeah, I think it's about 2,200 hours.
Wow. I don't have 2,200 hours in all the planes I've flown, so that's pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, somebody else is paying for the gas when you're flying the F-100, which makes it a little bit more affordable. During your life, you've witnessed aviation mature from limited transportation for only a few to arguably the most prolific form of transportation we have in the world. What do you think is in the future for aviation? Where do you see aviation going? Do you think it's going to continue to grow, or do you think it's going to be replaced by something else?
No, I think it's going to continue to grow. I can't imagine what would replace it.
So, along those lines, recently in the news we had an airliner that lost an engine. That engine was had a blade failure, as what they think the preliminary investigation is. And obviously, when an engine destructs in the way that this engine did on this airliner, it was quite a spectacular show. Given that, all the systems, all the engineering that was designed into that engine performed very well. Nothing penetrated the cabin. But I'm sure that the pilots had to do a lot of thinking and quick thinking. Given this push towards autonomous aircraft, do you see an autonomous aircraft in the future for commercial aviation? Do you think that this is something that is going to cause troubles? Do you see troubles for autonomous aircraft? Do you think the pilot will ever be replaced in that cockpit?
Yeah, I think you have to be there.
In order to assess what's going on.
Yeah.
I have one final question for you. This question is sort of philosophical. I like to ask it with somebody that's got all the experience that you have. Somebody that has lived an incredible life like you have. Somebody where you're looked up upon, you're a hero to several people. And that is, what kind of advice could you give anybody that is just now starting off in aviation? What would you tell them?
Well, go for it.
Go for it? Well, Arnold, it's been an absolute honor to sit here and have a chat with you today. I look forward to running across your path here at Harvey Field many, many more times. And if there's anybody I could ask for a wingman, you'd be it. I really appreciate all your contribution to the aviation world and to the EAA in particular. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me here.
My pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with aviation's past, and now I'd like to bring you a short interview with aviation's future.
Well, welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios, and today I am very excited to bring you some youth in aviation. We have a very 14-year-old girl here by the name of Ishitha Ara Kapudi. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
All right. I'm so happy for myself. So, Ishitha, 14 years old, and I have to tell you that the energy that I see from you towards aviation is absolutely outstanding. Kind of tell our listeners, how did you first get interested in aviation?
So, I have some really big dreams. I want to become an astronaut when I'm older. And for that, it's really good to have piloting experience. And so that's how I started to get involved with aviation. I was looking for ways to different aviation programs or what I could do right now. And I came across the Young Eagles program, and I thought it was really amazing that EAA had this opportunity for young people. And after learning a lot about it and after reading about aviation, I knew that this was something I wanted to continue to do. And another thing that motivated me is that I can fly a glider solo at 14, And so that's amazing at such a young age that I can actually do that.
You go online and you find out about EAA Young Eagles. And at that point, you contacted Chapter 84. And from that point, you were connected with somebody that offered to give you a Young Eagles flight. Who was that?
That was Jim, the president of Chapter 84.
Jim Magui, great guy. And Jim set up a Young Eagles flight for just you, or was it you and your sister?
Me and my sister. Her name is Tanvi, and she is 12.
Yeah, and she's in the studio with us today, too, looking on. At this point, Jim sets up a EA 84 Young Eagles flight with you, and kind of tell us about what that was. Where was it at? And kind of run us through what that Young Eagle flight experience was like.
So I had my first Young Eagles flight in December at Harvey Field. And we went up in his Zenith CH-650. And it was a really amazing experience for me because I had no idea what to expect when we started to lift off. And I thought it would be like traveling in an airplane, which I had done many times before. But it was really so much better. My flight experience is one of the most amazing things in the world, and I felt like I was so free when I was up there, and like the fact that I got to control some of that, and I got to pilot the flight for a bit was so amazing. I was actually in control of something so big, and that was really memorable for me. Yeah, he taught me all about like what all the controls did, and then like if you pulled the controller to the side, we went to the side, and like if you pull forward, we kind of got lifted out of our seats, which I thought was so amazing. And then just like trying to like maneuver that was really amazing.
So kind of walk me through the very details of the Young Eagle experience. Jim sets up this appointment with you. You show up down here at Harvey Airfield, and Jim opens up his hangar to this airplane. What happened after Jim brought you into the airplane? What was the first thing that he did with you?
The first thing is he showed me like all about the airplane, what the wings did, what certain parts of everything did, and even stuff that I thought were like maybe just for design or trivial were so important to how the airplane functioned. And so he taught us all about like what the wings did, what the propellers did, what the elevator and rudders did, which I thought was so interesting because I had no idea about this before. And then we got into the flight and we started going over this checklist to make sure everything was safe to fly, everything was functioning properly. And so it was a really big checklist, which I didn't even know pilots even had a checklist before flying. Next, he showed me all of the controls, all of the control panel, what everything did, what everything meant, like where you could find the altitude, where you saw like which direction you were going. And so I always saw in movies, like, there's these so many buttons that are in an airplane, and it was, like, so cool that I got to know what each of those buttons actually did.
So did you find it difficult to control the airplane?
When I was actually flying the airplane, it was a bit difficult because I didn't know, like, how softly or hardly I should push or pull. I didn't know, like, if I pulled it this much, like, would the plane topple over or would it just move slightly? And so it was kind of scary, but once I got the hang of it, it made it a bit easier. And Jim was like telling me what to do and telling me that it was like, okay. And I wasn't like, he was definitely helping me calm down and like actually use the experience to learn. And so I think having that really helped me experience it the fullest.
Great. And so now you've gone through the takeoff. Jim's flying along. He's letting you control the airplane a little bit. You start to come back to the airport. Kind of tell us about the experience of having that first landing in an airplane. What was that like?
I thought it would be a lot more bumpy or like a lot more turbulence, but really it was soft. We just like landed and it was done. I thought it would be a lot different because like in planes you land like really far down and so it's a bit shaky, but it was a lot different.
Okay. And then you get out of the airplane, and what happens after you get out of the airplane? Was there some sort of a marching band there waiting for to play a big tune when you get out, or was it just more subtle? What happened after that?
Well, I got on the plane, and my parents and my sister were there, and we were kind of celebrating because that was like such an amazing experience for me, and it was the first thing that I've ever done that was really connected to aviation, so it was a big step for me. And so, well, then we went back to the hangar, and we started talking about getting a Young Eagle certificate and going into, like, getting my name in the logbook. And so he showed me some opportunities about, like, the Sporty's flying course and how I could start doing that and just other ways from home that I could get involved with aviation.
Great. You've got this incredible excitement for aviation. Is this something that is throughout your family, or are you the first in your family to sort of get excited about aviation and aerospace?
Actually, I'm the first in my family. My no one in my family really is interested in aviation that much. My dad supports me a lot. He really likes space, but they don't really have like jobs or careers in aviation, so I'm kind of the first there.
That's wonderful. Having the family support there is a surefire way to succeed. You've gone through this aviation, EA Young Eagle aviation experience, and your excitement shows after the flight, and you go home and you decide that you want to get more involved with aviation and the EAA chapter. So you send Jim an email and you just tell him that you really want to get more involved. Jim sends that email out to the board, and we had a quick discussion about it, and we came up with what we thought was a wonderful plan for you. Tell us what Jim offered you after you sent him that email.
He offered me the role as the Young Eagle Youth Ambassador to spread like the word about aviation to youth, to the young people, like to community of youth, and to share it more with them. And so I was really excited about that because I had such an amazing experience and opportunity. And I know a lot of other young people who want to become pilots or know that they're very interested, but don't know how to start. So I was really excited that I got to share this opportunity with them.
So what's your goals with this program? What do you think you can do with the title of Youth Ambassador for the Young Eagles?
Well, firstly, I want to thank everyone in the chapter for giving me such an amazing role to spread aviation to young people. And there are so many opportunities that EAA has created, and I would really like to help further spread that message. And my Young Eagles flight experience was a step to my career, and I want to share that joy with other young people. And that's why I started a club at my school. It's called Skyriders, and lots of people who joined, and some of them know that they want to become pilots. Some of them know that they want to build planes when they're older. And some of them just are really interested in aviation. And so I'm really excited to share these opportunities with them. And we've even organized a rally for them. So a couple pilots go up at once with them. And it's on May 1st. And a lot of us, like, we're really excited for this.
Great. I'm glad to hear that. Do you have any idea how many people are going to participate? How many students are going to participate in this?
I'm not exactly sure on that, but I know about 10 people who like really want to do that.
Is this something that the school itself is supporting?
Yeah, the school is definitely supporting this idea and that they love this idea, but they're not that involved with the making of it, if that makes sense.
You're really early in this aviation career of yours. Have you decided what your favorite airplane is yet?
I actually have not. I mean, currently right now, my mind's all set on a glider because I want to fly a glider solo at 14. So that's kind of all I'm thinking about.
Something else that I know that since aerospace and becoming an astronaut is really your end goal here, you must have a favorite planet. What is your favorite planet?
Mars. Definitely Mars.
Why is that?
I really like Mars because of its possibility to have sustained life in the past. And that's just really fascinating to me. And that it was so much like Earth. And I want to kind of know why it's not like Earth anymore or what stopped it. And maybe that can help us keep Earth alive, keep it going. And I also want to help make Mars our second home. So if we ever need to go anywhere, I want Mars to be a place where we can go. And I want to help make that possible. And I'm also really interested in Perseverance, the newest rover that's landed there. And our first ever liftoff on Mars with Ingenuity. And I think just that's just so fascinating that we've actually been able to do that.
Explain to our listeners what Ingenuity is.
Ingenuity is a helicopter that they sent to Mars with the rover Perseverance, and they've been finding so many cool things. And Ingenuity had its first, the first liftoff ever on Mars. So like here on Earth with space shuttle launches, like we launch stuff off Earth, but we've never actually done that on another planet. And so Mars is the first planet that we've had something lift off of. And so the helicopter Ingenuity was the first to do that. And that's like a huge milestone.
What do you think they had to overcome? What sort of problems and engineering obstacles that they had to overcome to do that first flight?
Well, I think one of the main things is they couldn't actually see Ingenuity like live. Everything's like delayed 20 minutes, and that they don't know the weather there or like exactly like what's around it, the surrounding, like the geographical climate. And so I really think that's one of the major things. Like that 20-minute delay, they can't control anything for like 20 minutes. And so if something goes wrong, they can't really do anything.
So we've kind of talked a little bit about your excitement in aviation. We've talked about where you think you're going to go with aviation. You want to be able to do someday walk on Mars, I would imagine. That would be a great goal for you. I think you've got the energy to do that. Kind of tell me if you have, at this point in your life, do you have any heroes, any role models that you think that are inspiring you to do this?
Definitely. All of my heroes and role models are definitely all of the brave people who have fought for the opportunity of space, even when everyone said they couldn't. Like the Mercury 13, for example, in the 1960s, they were fighting for the opportunity to become astronauts, even when like NASA and society were like, that's a men's role, or like women can't do that. They fought against that and stood up so future generations of female astronauts had that opportunity to go to space. And like that, I did an entire project on them because I was so amazed by what they had done then, and like they were so inspiring. And Eileen Collins is definitely another one of my role models. She was the first one female to command a space shuttle, and I think that's really amazing. Another thing is I grew up reading stories of people who fought against barriers and who made the change so others could have it easier, others could have more opportunities, and I want to help make that history for some things. I want to help people in the future get things that they might not have had an opportunity to do.
I think that's an admirable goal. One of the things that I absolutely love about aviation is that aviation has been open to everybody, all races, all genders, pretty much since the beginning. You've got Amelia Earhart, Bessie Coleman. Aviation is a great way to bring everybody together. How can you use aviation to do that?
I think that there's no barriers in aviation for us. And so it's our passion that really drives us together. And so passion is a big part in creating the aviation community. And I think that's how we can expand on it, because no matter who we are, what our race is, what our gender is, passion and dreaming are the most important thing to bring us together as a community.
Bringing people together would also be bringing the youth together. Do you have any ideas how we can bring youth into the aerospace community and how we can continue to expand that going forward?
I think the most important thing is letting youth know about these opportunities. Like, I didn't really know about this opportunity. And when I did, I was so amazed, like, that there was this opportunity for me. But I'm not sure a lot of youth know that. And so I think the most important thing is to push it out, like, promote it more, get them to see that this is an opportunity that's waiting for them. And so I think that's definitely one of the biggest things.
Well, Ishita, I think you are definitely somebody who's going to be a great role model yourself. You're going to be a great youth ambassador going forward. And I think you're going to be one of those people that are going to be a leader in doing that. Before we close up here, I just had sort of my last question, which is a little bit of a philosophical question, but I got to ask you, which is, what do you think the future of aviation is? How do you think aviation's going to be in 20 years, aviation going forward even further out than that?
I think the future aviation is going to be really big. Like, as common as driving with cars are, I think aviation's going to go to that level. And, like, even if it's just commercial or private pilots, I think there's going to be a lot more of that. And because of this, I feel like autopiloting will be used a lot more. Like, maybe on really long flights, half of it will be used, will be piloted without an actual pilot. And so I also think planes will become, like, a lot more faster, a lot more safer than it is right now. And that regular vehicles will be made to fly, like flying cars. And I know that's already happening right now, so I feel like that'll be a lot more common. And another big thing is flying in space. I think spaceflight will be a lot more common, and having the opportunity to go to space won't be as rare as it is right now to become an astronaut. Kind of like a space Uber, I guess.
That's a great answer. I know I said that was the last question, but we're going to be a little flexible here. And I had one last thing that popped in my head, which is, if you had any advice for youth, 14-year-olds, younger, going forward, what would that advice be to them?
I think my advice to them would definitely be to look. Just to look for these opportunities. Like, now that we have the internet, it's so easy to just type up aviation opportunities. And that's how I found out about the Young Eagles opportunity. And so doing that really changed aviation for me, like made it so much more interesting. So really just looking for those opportunities where you live. And I know Young Eagles opportunities are like everywhere. So wherever you live, there's going to be something close to you. And another thing is to never stop believing in yourself. Like, believing in yourself is one of the most important things, because if you don't believe in yourself, no one else is going to. And so if you believe in yourself, then that's the most important thing.
Ashita, it has been absolutely wonderful talking to you this afternoon. I can't wait to see where you go. I want to be able to say one day when you're walking on Mars that I knew her when. That would absolutely be wonderful.
Thank you so much for this amazing opportunity.
Thanks for coming down to the Flappy Bottom Flying Club Studios.
And now some chapter news. This month's meeting will be held May 11th, starting at 7 p.m. This meeting will be sort of a hybrid, in that a few members will be allowed to attend in person at Harvey Field, Hangar 15. These members must pre-register with President Jim McGooey by May 10th. Of course, this could all change depending on pandemic case numbers, so make sure you watch for any announcements on our social media channels. The presentation this month will be from Dark Arrow. Keegan Carl and his two brothers River and Riley started Dark Arrow with the goal to develop a simple-to-build and highly efficient two-place aircraft for the experimental market. You can get more details on their website, darkarrow.com. The chapter is still looking for a hangar manager. If you're interested, please contact President Jim McGooey and he can discuss the details. The Chapter Young Eagles flight program had a successful mini rally on May 1st, where seven youths were able to experience flight, some for the first time. The chapter wishes to thank Rich Morrison for his coordination efforts, and of course our Young Eagles Youth Ambassador, Ashita Arakapudi, for getting the word out about the event. Well, that wraps it up for this month's podcast. I hope you enjoyed hearing from our guests. Spread the word about Chapter 84 podcast to your friends. It's available for download on most popular apps, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcast. Until next time, this has been your host, David Weber. And remember in life, stay off the brakes, keep moving forward.